And ladies and gentlemen, in our second hour, we will be joined in just a couple of minutes here. Arthur Ken Anderson will join the program to discuss his book, How to Change Your Drinking, A Harm Reduction Guide to Alcohol. And I believe this is Kenneth joining the show right now. Hi,
yeah,
Kenneth
this
Anderson.
This is me, Amanda.
Hi, welcome to the show. This is Community Talks.
Hi, thank you for having me on the show. How are you doing?
I'm fine. It's a really beautiful day here. I've had many delightful guests, and I'm so happy that you were able to join the show to talk about your book. First of all, most of us have never heard of harm reduction. You know, out there when we look at addiction or alcoholism, we pretty much tell people to just stop, hit rock bottom, or just to stop. What is harm reduction? How does that work?
Harm reduction is a strategy that encourages every positive change. The best known examples of harm reduction in the addictions field in the United States are needle exchange programs. We tell people, you know, maybe shooting heroin is not such a good idea, but if you're going to do it, you should use a clean needle and not transmit HIV virus. So this is one example of how to do harm reduction. There are other things. See, harm reduction is actually a very common practice in many areas. When we talk about people driving automobiles, driving an automobile is a high-risk behavior. Do we tell people, everyone, you must stop driving your automobile, no one should ever drive again? If everyone stops driving, there will be no accidents. Is that a sensible approach?
Absolutely.
No, what we do is we invented a harm reduction device called a seatbelt. And we say, okay, if you're going to drive, reduce the risk. If you're going to get into an accident, if you have a seatbelt on, you reduce the chance of injury, because we know we can't stop everybody from driving. You know, the current society is very dependent on the automobile, even in New York City. I mean, people have to drive sometimes. So harm reduction is any approach that reduces harm. Another thing that people think sometimes is that harm reduction is opposed to abstinence, and this is not true at all. Abstinence is one way to reduce harm. Once again, with driving an automobile, if you decide not to drive at all, that's one way to prevent accidents. Another way, if you do decide to drive, you use your seatbelt. You know, if with drinking alcohol, with using drugs, stopping completely is a way to reduce harm, and we're totally in favor of that. A lot of people that get involved in harm reduction programs do eventually go to complete abstinence. They stop drinking alcohol completely, or they stop using drugs, or they stop using the drug that was causing them the big problems. What we've found, clinical treatment and clinical research are rather at odds these days, because clinical research has demonstrated that things like cognitive behavioral therapy, motivational interviewing, harm reduction approaches, I'll talk more about all of these as we go along, these are all very effective tools. What is not effective is getting in people's faces, confronting them, saying, you must stop immediately, you must go to AA meetings. People who are confronted tend to just react and want to do the exact opposite of what you've been confronting them about. Clinical trials of 12-step treatment programs have been conducted by, for example, Jeffrey Bransma did a classic study published in 1980, and we found that the people in the 12-step treatment program didn't do better than the people in the control group. Cognitive behavioral therapies were far more successful. They were about twice as successful, but the current approach is still, you know, 95% of treatment centers in the United States are 12-step based. If you listen to Dr. Drew or Dr. Phil or these other first-name doctors, you know, they're pushing this one approach, and it's not the most effective approach. The research actually says things like cognitive behavioral therapy teach people to change their thinking, and it will be easier for them to stop drinking or at least be safer or to drink less, and the same with their drug use. Cognitive behavioral therapy is very helpful. Also, motivational interviewing is something new that's been developed. You talk to people, you say, okay, what are the good things about drinking alcohol? What are some of the bad things? Well, do you think the bad things are things you want to eliminate? What kind of strategy could you take to eliminate them? And, you know, some people, after they start thinking about this for a while, will decide that they do want to stop drinking completely. Others will decide they want to reduce, they want to control it, they want to be safer. Our program offers the options of safer drinking, reduced drinking, or quitting. We're the only really purely harm reduction-based program for people that use alcohol.
All right. Ken, you know, to the greater society, we've been taught through media, through publication, that alcoholism is, in fact, a disease. And the only cure to alcoholism is to abstain, just completely wipe it out of your life. We also have been taught that alcoholism, that is, affects everyone in the family, that alcoholism actually becomes a family systematic way of family members relating to one another for several generations. How does harm reduction address that? If you have someone, if we acknowledge that alcoholism is a disease, and we talk about reducing, you know, reducing the drinking for someone that's addicted, someone that has a physiological and psychological component that goes into that addiction, help me to understand how harm reduction really could be effective for that person as opposed to the casual thinker or the binge drinker that may be depressed for a period and has taken up drinking and then he or she has now stopped or could use harm reduction. But the alcoholic, the actual alcoholic, it's a sickness. How does a harm reduction work? How effective is it on an individual like that?
Okay. First, if we had a 100% surefire way to make alcoholics stop drinking completely, that would be a solution. But first we have to ask, is there something effective we can do to make these people stop drinking? Clinical studies of sending people to AA against their will when they don't want to go show that it's not any more effective than doing nothing at all. One of the big myths we have is that AA attendance or clinical treatment or something is required to quit drinking, but the NIAAA, which is the U.S. government, has published the studies that say that 75% of people who are alcoholics will resolve the problem on their own without treatment or without going to a 12-step program or attending AA. So the idea that we have this progressive disease that always leads to death is actually completely contradicted by the clinical research. Now, there are some people that self-select to go to AA, and they are very successful with it. And, you know, I don't have anything to say against people who find AA helpful. If you find it helpful, go for it. I have many of my colleagues and friends who work in harm reduction. They work in needle exchange. They're members of Narcotics Anonymous. They say, you know, it's very helpful to them, but many, many others find just the opposite to be true. I personally tried going to AA. It made me drink more. In fact, it put me in the hospital with severe withdrawal. I'd never drank as much in my life as before that, and I've met many people with the same experience. So this is just not a solution that works for everyone.
Okay, fair enough. When we talk about harm reduction, have you been able to approach the criminal justice system or the family court system, you know, those who may lose their families due to alcoholism and it becomes a family court matter, you know, custody children, or those who, for drunk driving, for example, in being able to incorporate harm reduction into part of the sentencing or court-appointed or sanctioned treatment that an individual should go through. How has harm reduction, or if it has, been able to become a part of the criminal justice system or family court system?
It's a really interesting
question. As an alternative treatment.
Mm-hmm. It's a very interesting question, and the answer, currently, no, it has not been incorporated at all into the criminal justice system in any instance that I know of. If you are arrested for using heroin, you are sent to prison. you aren't told, you know, make sure to use clean needles so you don't infect other people. Our organization has not currently tried to approach the criminal justice system. I'm not certain that's something we want to do or not. We're still thinking about it. What we have been doing in New York City, New York City has borough councils on chemical dependency. There's a Manhattan Borough Council, there's a Brooklyn Borough Council, and I've been going to their meetings and introducing them to these ideas. There's been some receptiveness, particularly in New York City. Our commissioner, Dahlia Heller, has a harm reduction background. She originally was executive director of a needle exchange in Manhattan and later became the commissioner. So there is some receptiveness here to the idea of incorporating it into treatment systems, because we know that, you know, getting in people's face saying the only thing you can do is abstain, it's not a very successful way to do treatment. The outcomes aren't very good.
Now, I'm noting here that a part of the treatment plan for harm reduction, it includes research, and then you have CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, mm-hmm. and then RET, the rational motive therapy. For, those are sophisticated terms for those who are laymen, people looking for alternatives for family members or even themselves. What are you saying in that, that we do more than put you in a circle and have you tell your story? We actually help you go to the root of your problem. We engage you one-on-one in a therapeutic mental health component-type design program. Is that what you're...
Yes. Our program is
how
actually...
How does harm reduction work is what I'm asking. Mm-hmm.
Sorry. Our program is a support group for people who drink alcohol, and we support any goal from safer drinking to reduce drinking to quitting altogether. We introduce people to some cognitive behavioral techniques that they can use to change their thinking. If people have problems with depression and they want to drink alcohol to drown the depression, we say, here are ways to deal with the depression so you won't be so depressed, you won't need to rely on the alcohol to get rid of the depression. You can use these cognitive behavioral techniques. I mean, they're not all complicated. Some are like thought stopping. When you recognize the bad thought that's going to make you depressed, you tell that thought, stop, and you try to replace it with a positive thought. And when people are less depressed, then they have less need to drink to drown out their depression. The same with people who have anxiety or social phobia. They can use some cognitive behavioral techniques to deal with these. In our groups, we teach simple techniques that anyone can incorporate. We also recommend people that want to go to the root of the problem to go to a professional therapist and, you know, do therapy with a professional therapist and work on the roots of the problems too, because, you know, many people are driven to drink by outside issues, by, you know, their depression, anxiety, social phobia.
All right, and then use cognitive behavioral therapy. Of course, we're talking, in layman terms, we're talking role modeling, getting around healthy people who can role model for you.
That's one aspect of it. It's okay. We're talking about techniques to change your thinking from bad thinking to good thinking. This goes all the way back to the Stoic philosophers like Epictetus, you know, who said, you know, you are in charge of your own mind. And that's really where it developed from. It developed into rationally motive therapy, and the most recent version is cognitive behavioral therapy. It's all very similar. It's saying you're in control of your thoughts. If you have this bad thought for anxiety, depression, whatever, you can stop that thought and replace it with a good thought instead. You have to kind of get outside yourself and learn to observe. But it's very successful in helping people to deal with depression, anxiety, anger, all kinds of negative emotions.
Now, you, it's noted here that you have been involved in the field of harm reduction since 2002. How successful has the program been? I know I approached that talking about the criminal justice system and the family court, maybe taking a look at such a program as yours as an alternative. But in other respects, how receptive has this been in the community at large? It looks as if you have a number of clinical professionals that are joining your efforts, but overall?
We have to talk a little bit about evidence. Our program of harm reduction for alcohol is modeled on proven successful programs for drug users that have been evaluated in clinical trials. We also use the cognitive behavioral and motivational interviewing techniques that have been subjected to clinical trials. They've been proven in clinical trials to be helpful. So we are modeled on them. We have not yet had a researcher come in and study our program against a control group. So in terms of evidence base, our program rates fair. If we can get an evaluator to actually do a clinical trial, we can get that rating from fair to very good. Ratings of other harm reduction programs, such as needle exchange, opening a needle exchange in a community definitely makes the HIV rates in that community drop very sharply. This has been investigated over and over again. And it does not increase drug use, but it does decrease the HIV rates. So we know that these kind of programs that accept people where they are at with their drug use and give them means to be safer drug users are very effective in eliminating some of the harms associated with drug use, not only to the individual users, but to the community at large.
You know, there's an extra element of risk when we get into talking about any type of addiction or substance abuse, such as crack or whatever it may be, aside from alcohol. So the programs, the therapeutic programs that are structured address that also because the criminal aspect enters into the picture if the individual is caught. But alcoholism, unless you literally get into a vehicle and begin driving, you can pretty much destroy yourself in silence. It's illegal to drink. It's legal to go into any store that has a liquor license or bar and get something that can be very, very damaging for you. Let me ask you this. It's noted here about that you're a guest speaker at the Harlem Hospital Harm Reduction Program. Are there any other hospitals where this program is available? And tell us about the Harlem Hospital Harm Reduction Program. If you're suffering with alcoholism, you want to become a part of what you have to offer, can I call Harlem Hospital and say, hey, help me? Can I sign up? Can I join?
The Harlem Hospital Program is only for people who are HIV positive. They've invited me to be a guest speaker because a lot of their participants drink alcohol and they need some strategies to be safer drinkers. You know, they found that the confrontational approach doesn't work. It just makes them drink more. So just telling them stop doesn't work. But I've given the people in this program an opportunity to talk about planning ways to be safer, to have days when they don't drink. That's one of the really important aspects of harm reduction is to have abstinence days. And one person I was thinking I was talking to there said, you know, I like to go see my family in Brooklyn like 5 days a week and not drink anything. I come back here and I drink my 2 days and then I go there again. And when I'm around my family, I can stay straight and alcohol free. I don't want to be there all the time, but, you know, most of the time. And, you know, this is from someone that used to drink every day and become very intoxicated, and they've changed to find a plan where they can drink much, much less, have many alcohol-free days, have good days with their family, and they're making really great improvements in their life.
Okay. Ken, you're recovering. Are you sharing with us that you have recovered from alcoholism yourself?
Yes, I'm happy to tell my story. I don't mind that at all. We usually don't ever talk about alcoholism or disease or any of that. We always concentrate on the idea of high-risk behaviors, negative behaviors versus lower-risk behaviors, more positive behaviors. I've changed my drinking habits. My drinking habits were to drink about 4 days out of the week, be very intoxicated. I would go into work hungover, get into all kinds of, you know, problems because of being, you know, careless and really drinking a lot. I would want to sober up like 3 days out of the week so I didn't have withdrawal. Then eventually I got involved with AA and 12-step treatment programs and started drinking more and started having, you know, bad withdrawal. I had to check into a hospital so I didn't die of a heart attack from alcohol withdrawal. And it was at that point, you know, I said there had to be a better way to do this. I started looking around. There were moderation programs for alcohol. There were harm reduction programs for drug users. But there wasn't anything that brought the harm reductions right directly to the alcohol users. And eventually, after being involved with both moderation programs for alcohol, and I was a volunteer for about 2 years in Needle Exchange, doing harm reduction for drug users, I said, you know, I need to put these two things together. Because I had, by that time, developed my own harm reduction program, drink no more than two nights per week, abstain at least 5 days out of the week, don't drink on work nights, don't leave the house when you're drinking. And this was going really well for me. I needed to, you know, I knew there were a lot of people out there that would not accept abstinence. They were not going to become completely moderate drinkers that had never exceeded four drinks in a day and never exceeded 14 drinks in a week. Those are moderate limits for men for drinking. And, you know, a lot of we're talking standard drinks, not bar drinks. This is like 14 beers in a week. A lot of people won't want to go for that. And they're not going to go for total abstinence. But can we encourage them to be safer? Most people that drink, yes, they don't want to cause accidents. They don't want to get in trouble. They would like to be safer. They can't get any support if they try to be safer. If they try to cut back, they can't get support in that either because, you know, they get people right in their face being confrontational. You have to stop completely. You have to go to AA. You have to have a spiritual program. You have to have a higher power. Lots of people are atheists. They don't want a higher power. It's not helpful for them to tell them they have to have a higher power. So we offer them an opportunity to change in ways which they choose for themselves. And this is really at the heart of all harm reduction programs. Harm reduction does not attempt to change people in ways which they do not choose for themselves.
All right, fair enough. Can you, according to harm reduction, since we're looking at this with a new revolutionized way, is what you're offering a new approach to addressing alcoholism or the care of alcoholics? How many days must you drink? How often must you drink? How much alcohol must you consume, according to harm reduction, to be considered even an alcoholic?
We don't ever
change the definition of alcoholism that way.
We don't use the word alcoholic, and we don't talk about how much you have to drink or how little you have to drink. We say to people, is alcohol causing you any problems? Are there any changes you'd like to make to have fewer problems? Are there any changes you want to make to improve your life? This is what harm reduction is all about. There aren't any boundary lines that are black and white. And you say, on this side of the line, you're alcoholic. On that side of the line, you're not. Actually, the research has never found any boundary lines. It's a continuum from people who have no problems at all, people who have small problems, people who have larger problems. And it's not progressive. This is something that's been totally contradicted by research. People can stop drinking at any stage, or they can reduce their drinking at any stage so that they are no longer having problems. People are capable of change at any stage. It's not, there's no requirement to hit bottom. When you're ready to change, you will change.
You know, what I like about your book, Kenneth, and you're listening to Kenneth Anderson, who is the author of How to Change Your Thinking, Harm Reduction, is that you highlight, the book highlights that your principles, your focus is meeting people where they are at and encouraging people who are participating in harm reduction support groups to be even better. Can you tell us, how can we find a harm reduction support group? Where are you at in the country? How can someone get involved or even start their own harm reduction support group in their city or area?
Okay. Currently, our harm reduction support groups are strongest online. We have a live chat that's at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, 6 p.m. Pacific, that meets every night of the week. You can get there from our website, hamsnetwork.org. That's hams like the kind of hams that you eat, hamsnetwork.org. You can get to our chat room that meets every evening. There's also an email group, and the chat and email have people from all over the world participating. So far, in terms of live meetings, we've got one live meeting in Brooklyn. I mean, we're a pretty new organization. We only got started in 2007. We only got our book published, you know, about 6 months ago. So we're quite new.
I think what you're doing is wonderful work. It very much so gives us a new perspective in addressing a very chronic a disease. Do you consider it a disease at harm reduction? Is alcoholism a disease?
It's very strange. You know, what classifying a behavior as a disease is an interesting and odd kind of a thing. It's a, because it's in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, the DSM-4, that makes it legally a disease. But because the American Psychiatric Association voted by a majority vote that it's a disease. However, until the mid-70s, homosexuality was a disease. It was in the Diagnostic Statistical Manual as a mental illness. Then in the mid-70s, the American Psychiatric Association voted, it's not a disease anymore, it's an alternate lifestyle. Once again, in the 1950s, 1960s, very heavy drinking was accepted as not a disease. According to the definition published in the 1970s, a person had to drink a quart of alcohol a day for at least 2 days in a row to be considered an alcoholic. And now the standard is more like if you exceed five drinks in a day, that's like five beers, you are a binge drinker and you are potentially an alcoholic. The definitions have changed very much based on, you know, popular perception. Heavy drinking is, it's rather unpopular now. It was rather popular in the 60s, even into the 70s. Homosexuality in that period was very unpopular. Some people wanted to call it a crime. Some wanted to call it a disease. Nowadays, you know, it's much more accepted. These are just people. Let's accept them as who they are. So I think it's very relative of what kind of behavior we call a disease and what kind of behavior we don't call a disease.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You know, Ken, it's noted here also that you do have a master's degree in psychology and substance abuse counseling. So you do work in a therapeutic, you can work in a therapeutic setting with someone that comes to you with a crisis. I wanted to know, when we're talking about alcoholism or harm reduction or helping a person get a grip or gain control of his or her life, you know, alcoholism impacts family, it impacts employment. Other people become involved or are involved in this particular, I say disease, but you just redefine that for me. How does harm reduction address families and community in terms of
okay.
helping the person to? Mm-hmm.
We have just recently started a new support group online called Harmless, which is aimed at friends and family of people that drink alcohol to help them reduce the harm that comes in their life from their loved ones' behavior, also to try and help them find ways to change their loved ones' behavior and to find ways to psychologically deal with the problems raised by their loved ones' behavior. So this is one thing that we are just starting out now. It's a new online support group we've just started, and you can find this if you go to hamsnetwork.org/harm-less. Or you can just Google Al-Anon Alternatives, and it will come right up. Part of this is based on our own experiences, and we're telling people, okay, here's some ways to suggest to your loved one who drinks ways to, you know, reduce the harm, reduce the amounts if the person is interested in making changes. But also there's other people who have been researching in a similar vein for the past decade or so. There's something called CRAFT, Community Reinforcement and Family Therapy, CRAFT. They have a book out. It's called Get Your Loved One Sober, Alternatives to Nagging and Pleading. And it's a book that I highly recommend. I have a copy of it. I've read through it. It's a really good book, and it gives some effective ways to try and work on changing your loved one's behavior, because the typical ways that we know of confrontation, of nagging and pleading are not effective. These approaches are more based on motivational interviewing, and you can talk to your loved one and say, are there, you know, what are some things you like about alcohol? What are some things you don't like about alcohol? This is the formal term for this is a cost-benefit analysis. It can be done formally on paper. You can also do it in a very informal setting. Just say, what do you like about drinking? What don't you like? And you know, if you're not confrontational, people are very willing often to say, well, you know, I got three DUIs. This is really bad. I'm going to lose my driver's license. You know, this is a really bad aspect of drinking. Maybe I want to change some things because this is impacting me badly. And, you know, you can encourage people to make smaller changes, or you can encourage them to make large changes. The book I was referring to talks largely about getting people into treatment programs, but it has excellent strategies, and you can also use cognitive behavioral therapy yourself as a loved one to cope with some of the negative things that your loved one is doing. Another thing that Kraft suggests is refusing to engage in high-risk behaviors with the loved one. If the loved one is drunk and going to drive, don't get in the automobile and ride with them. If they come home drunk and belligerent, don't argue, leave, go elsewhere. There are many ways in which the Kraft approach teaches people to reduce the harm from their loved one's drinking, and I think it's very compatible with our approach for the drinker. I think the two will go together well.
You know, Ken, is America as a nation in denial about the seriousness of alcoholism, how it changes the psychological makeup of the individual that usually suffers with alcoholism? Are we in denial as a nation about alcoholism overall?
My impression is not that we're in denial. My impression is actually that we're trying to scare people into joining 12-step programs and getting involved with rehabs a lot. I mean, this is what I see people like Dr. Drew and Dr. Phil doing. But, you know, as I said, clinical treatment seems very divorced from clinical research. We know most people will get better on their own. They will choose to change themselves. They don't need a rehab or a 12-step or joining a 12-step group necessarily. What I think really helps a lot is giving people information. Now, I said we run a support group, but actually we redefined it to call it a support and informational group because we told people if you don't feel you need to participate in the support group, you're not required to. If you think you just need the information and can apply it, go ahead. Take the information, take it, apply it. You know, once again, this is meeting people where they are at. We are telling them, you know, do what's going to work for you. Not everyone needs to be involved in a support group.
All right, fair enough. Ken, can you talk, you mentioned earlier, and I think this is a good point, and I like the fact that your book, Harm Reduction, the exact title is How to Change Your Drinking, A Harm Reduction Guide to Alcohol. You mentioned just a little while ago about nagging and pleading by a family member or a friend is an ineffective approach when dealing with someone who is trying to overcome their drinking habit. You know, but my question is that you really have to understand, you can't, for example, I don't have, or someone that does not have an alcohol problem would not be an effective person to try to work with, someone that does, but you agree with that? Do you need to be an addict? Do you need to be a survivor? Do you need to be someone that is in recovery in order to be able to work effectively with someone that's trying to get where you are? Do you understand what I'm asking you?
Yes, yes, I do. And I don't think that's necessarily true. I think people can learn any kind of therapy, and they can learn to do therapy. I think that people, spouses, can learn to relate to their loved ones in new and different ways. What we find is, you know, spouses get these scripts that they enact. And, you know, for example, the husband comes home, he's a little schnockered, and the wife starts nagging and say, you need to stop drinking, you need to go AA. And he says, oh, boy, she's nagging me again. It's time to go out to the bar and really tie one out. And, you know, they do this over and over again, and it becomes a scripted behavior. And people need to break out of the scripted behavior, particularly if you want to change your loved one's drinking. You know, confronting them, if it hasn't worked before, it's not going to work this time. Find a different way. One way is to disengage with the situation. Say, I'm leaving. I'll come back, you know, tomorrow. Go to your mother's house or whatever opportunity you can take. Go to your friend's house. This is one thing. The other thing is, you know, not to confront, but, you know, wait for an opportunity when your loved one is not intoxicated and talk to them about drinking, what they like about it, what they don't like. And, you know, if you start eliciting things they don't like, pretty soon they have a big list of things that they don't like and a big list of reasons that they made for themselves to change. And when you make your own reasons that you want to change, that's when you are motivated to change, not when someone else makes a list outside and confronts you with it.
Are we dealing with a codependent person or someone who may be an addict themselves and to some degree to even stay with or stay in an alcoholic family system or someone who has a drinking problem?
Sometimes it is necessary to leave. About one-third of people, if I remember my numbers correctly, about one-third of people who have alcohol dependence also have antisocial personality disorder. Antisocial personality disorder, they used to call it a psychopath, a sociopath. It's people, it doesn't matter what you say to them, they're not going to change. You know, if you're involved with a sociopath, it doesn't matter whether this person drinks or doesn't drink or what. It's someone that you probably need to get away from and leave completely. You're not going to have much luck changing a person with antisocial personality disorder. But about two-thirds of people that drink alcohol, that are alcohol dependent, I should say, they do not have a diagnosis of antisocial personality disorder. And these people are amenable to change. They're good people. They just tend to drink too much. Maybe they got into a bad habit. Maybe they made some bad choices. But they don't want to hurt other people. You know, they're not fundamentally bad people, and they do want to make positive changes. And if given the opportunity, they will.
So harm reduction, the guide on how to change your drinking harm reduction, it deals with the individual that's actually drinking the alcohol, that has the actual drinking problem. Does it in any way help those, maybe the children, adult children of alcoholics that may not drink themselves but have an alcoholic personality, alcoholic behaviors? Growing up, do you work, does harm reduction, does the book help to touch that side of alcoholism, the family members, the children who are impacted by growing up with alcoholic parents?
We have not addressed that issue at all yet. We do address the issue for people who are living with someone who is actively drinking. We address primarily for spouses, but the same applies for children. The same things, you know, nagging doesn't work, but sometimes you need to disengage. Sometimes you need to talk to the person when they're sober about, you know, what they think. We've done much less with children, so that's a whole area to be addressed in the future.
Okay. So, you know, Ken, but is the alcoholic, because I'd like your approach, you're talking about meeting someone where they're at. And that is getting the person to agree that they need to make the change. Change has to come from within. It can't come from without. Mm-hmm. Is the alcoholic fully aware or aware of his or her behavior and its impact on others, and they just don't care? Are they aware?
You said fully aware first, and I would say not fully aware, but not fully unaware either. People know when alcohol is causing them problems. They know that. They're not totally unaware of that. Sometimes they need to become more aware of it. As I said, you know, when you give them a chance themselves to talk about the negative aspects of alcohol as well as the positive aspects, they start coming up with negatives and become more aware the more they talk. You know, whereas the confrontational approach tends not to work because, you know, the more reasons you come up with why alcohol is bad, the more reasons the drinker will come up with why it's good. This is just a normal part in a debate. The more you debate, the more the person defends the other side of the issue. It's why debating is not an effective approach at behavioral change.
Okay. And again, your book addresses that, and it offers a new effective approach to not just alcohol. We've been focusing in on alcohol, but to drugs as well. You're also a co-host on Blog Talk Radio. You do have a talk show here, and it is called Harm Reduction, for those who would like to follow up and continue to hear more about what harm reduction can do and how to get involved. You do have a show here on Blog Talk.
That's correct. And mostly I let my guests do the talking on the show. I don't do a lot of talking. I've made a lot of acquaintances in the field. I have a lot of colleagues that I've met. I've attended the last two harm reduction conferences. And so I've been very fortunate. People who work in harm reduction seem very open and friendly. And, you know, you can just shoot them an email, and you've never met them before in your life, and they'll right back to you. Oh, you're interested in harm reduction too. Let's get together. Let's work together. You know, it's a very friendly community. And so I've had many people who've done lots of research. They've had lots of practical experience in the field who have, they've become my colleagues. They've been guests on my show. They've written introductions or blurbs for my book.
Okay. You're listening to Kenneth Anderson. You are the founder and CEO of HAMS, like the ham that you eat, Harm Reduction Network. And you are the author of How to Change Your Drinking, A Harm Reduction Guide to Alcohol. And it is the second edition. You know, Ken, tell the listening audience, if someone wants to follow up with you, if they'd like to begin to have an actual support group in the community, not just online, or just talk to you more, you're available here on Blog Talk. The name of your show is Harm Reduction. How else can someone reach out to you?
Go to hamsnetwork.org. The contact info is listed on every page on the bottom. We have online posted a guide to creating a live meeting if you're interested in starting a live meeting in your community. We have all the information that you will need. Of course, you should get a copy of the book if you want to start a live meeting. And two things I want to say, and they're both in my mind at the same time. First, the acronym HAMS. It stands for Harm Reduction, Abstinence and Moderation Support, because we're a support group that encourages any goal from harm reduction to moderate drinking to abstinence. As I was saying earlier at the beginning, abstinence is a form of harm reduction. When you stop doing a risky behavior, whether it's shooting heroin, drinking alcohol, skydiving, driving an automobile, any risky behavior, you eliminate the harm associated with that behavior. Many of our members eventually go to abstinence as their choice. And, you know, they either find it's the easiest thing to do, that the controlling drinking is too difficult and they don't want to mess with it anymore. Some of them choose, say, one of my friends right now is on day 105, I think, of abstaining. He just says, I'm going to try and go for this year. And, you know, so this is definitely one aspect of harm reduction is abstinence. The thing that is not harm reduction is telling people you need to hit bottom. You need to have more consequences. You need to have more bad things happen to you. That's harm increase, and we're not in favor of harm increase, and we don't tell people you need to hit bottom. You need to drink more. You need to have more bad things happen to you. This is quite the opposite of our program.
When someone enters into the harm reduction method of dealing with addiction, how long is the program usually? When do you see, any, 18 months, 6 months? When do you begin to see addiction?
We're totally wide open in terms of time frame because we find that some people want to be part of a support group for life. Some want to get their life together and move on. We don't tell people, you know, you need to be involved for X amount of time. And we also don't have any requirement, you know, that you come back every week or every night or, you know, you participate as you feel the need for it. I mean, some people want to dip their toe into the water, see what this is about. Maybe it's a little scary. Maybe they go away for 6 months, come back 6 months later. Well, I want to look a little more deeply, come back again in 6 months. Okay, now I'm ready to get involved. You know, there's no pressure at all to change in ways that you don't choose to change for yourself. There's no rush. We let people take their own time, and when they are ready, they get involved, and then they reach a goal that they have set for themselves.
Okay. You know, can someone enter into your program being able to pay for it through medical insurance with it falling under mental health or, you know, in some of the traditional settings when families seek any type of addiction treatment, is that available with your program?
Okay. As I said before, we are a support group. I should have said we are a free-of-charge, lay-led support group. There are no insurance charges, no more than when you go to AA. There's no charge for that either. We are totally free. Most harm reduction programs you will find in the country don't charge any money. Needle exchanges are generally supported by some grants. Someone's found some grants somewhere. I mean, needle exchange programs in the U.S., got started out of the trunks of people's cars. It was completely illegal. There was no funding. But people saw their friends dying and said, you know, I can't deal with my friends dying. They need, you know, to be protected from HIV infections and other infections. Here's clean needles. I don't care if I get arrested. I'm going to deliver them out of the trunk of my car. And this is how, you know, harm reduction got started. It's always been very grassroots. It's, as I said, you know, I've not worked as a clinical professional. Our program is also very grassroots. We just developed because, several of us were in a moderate drinking program, and we said, well, this is a good program, but it's not the fit for us. We're not ready to go for these moderate drinking limits, but we want to reduce harm. So we broke off, we formed our own group, and said, okay, we're going to support every positive change. We're going to model ourselves on the needle exchanges, on what's been working for the drug users, because nobody's doing this for the drinkers. Nobody's doing the same thing for the people that drink alcohol, even though it's had such tremendous results with people who are drug users. So that's how we decided to start our program.
Okay. Now, earlier I had asked you about a harm reduction, being able to work with the, you know, criminal court system with DUIs and then family court. I know you're just starting with your program, you share that. Have you been able to get, you know, the attention of taking on your program? Because it sounds like an excellent program with certain employers who typically have a high incidence of alcoholism among its workers. Or government organizations. I know the military tends to have, you know, a high level of alcoholism and so forth. Have you been successful in getting the attention of any employers out there that would be willing to try your alternative method to deal with addiction?
It's something, these are things that I've been considering doing. I'd like to do them. I have to tell you this, our harm reduction program has really so far been a one-man show. So, I mean, we have a lot of members of the support group, but I've pretty much done all the work myself, and I've funded the thing by taking out student loans or by sweeping out a church in Brooklyn. So it's not, it's it's still a small thing, and it's still, you know, been very much. If I'm going to do something, I have to do it myself. We don't have any paid staff. In fact, we ran in the red last year. Well, I paid $8,000 out of my student loans to run the corporation, and the corporation's total expenses were $9,000. So that tells you we had $1,000 coming in donations. So it's really been run on a shoestring, basically out of my backpack.
Well, I definitely hope those who are listening in to the show will help to give your program the support that it needs. It certainly sounds like a wonderful alternative method, and I hope that I have shared in being able to get the word out that it even exists, how to change your drinking, a harm reduction guide to alcohol, second addiction, addition rather, and our guest has been Kenneth Anderson. And wow, I want to thank you so much for sharing. And I hope that those who are listening out there in government or employers would also entertain what you have to offer. And if you want to close out with anything, any upcoming meetings, the next time you're going to have your show, so that those can who are listening can follow up. Ken?
Our show will be this evening at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, 7 Central, and 5 Pacific. We're going to have a couple experts on doing harm reduction with crack cocaine. I would like to, if I could, just talk about the program a little bit before we stop. Our program has 17 elements, and we call them elements, not steps, because they are all optional, and they can be done in any order. And the elements include doing a cost-benefit analysis. We recommend people to write out the positives and negatives of their alcohol use. And it's very important not just to make a list of negatives. I mean, this has been tried in the past. They've done clinical trials, and making up a list of negatives just leaves all the positives in your self-conscious, and people relapse, you know, if they just make a list of everything bad about alcohol. If you can realize consciously what the benefits and what the negatives are, if you decide to quit completely, then you can find ways to fulfill these benefits that alcohol gives to you with other things. And even if you can't fulfill all of them with other things, you're at least aware that they're there. And when they come up, you are ready to meet them. So it's very important to list the benefits and costs of drinking. We also recommend people do charting of their drinking. Sometimes this is the place where people start. They start by writing down how much they drink every day. We teach them how to measure what a standard drink is. You can find that on the government website as well as our website. Measure what a standard drink is. Track how many drinks you drink each day. Sometimes people report reductions just as a result of tracking in and of itself. We also, you know, recommend that people learn to practice damage control. You know, eliminate, rank their risk, be aware of what kind of risks there are. And there are other things that you can do. Some people find that marijuana is much less harmful for them than alcohol, and they can substitute marijuana and stop drinking alcohol completely because, you know, marijuana doesn't ruin your liver. It doesn't cause withdrawal delirium or seizures, VTs. It's safer for people who have liver damage or problems with alcohol withdrawal. So there are many different things that you can do as part of our program that will help you to change your drinking for the better or to stop.
Okay, wonderful. You've been very kind with your time to come on to Community Talks and share with us about how to change your drinking. We're very honored to have had you to join us. And I want to thank you very much. And again, give your website one more time for those who'd like to follow up.
PamsNetwork.org.
Okay. And then, you have a show starting at 8 o'clock tonight for those that may want to listen in and give you a call. At 8 o'clock tonight, is that Central Time? Eastern Time?
7 Central. 7 Central.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much, Ken, for joining Community Talks for this hour. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, you've been listening to Community Talks. Thank you again for tuning in. It's been a fun-packed day, several guests on the program. And tune in next time for another edition of Community Talks. Thank you.